National Radio Club.
As you heard on Side 1, Bill Hale was telling you all about some AM on FM. That is, FM translators being used to relay AM stations. And it's finally become a reality. Mark Durenberger reports.
Well, it's official, folks. FCC okays AM on FM translators. This was written by Ron Whitworth for the law firm Fletcher, Heald & Hildreth, their blog for July. In an effort to provide a lifeline to an AM radio industry in continued and dramatic competitive decline, the commission has changed its rules to permit AM stations to rebroadcast their signals on FM translators under certain conditions. The long-awaited report and order, whose release was anticipated last fall, opens the door for considerable but not universal cross-service translation. Under the new rules, AM stations may rebroadcast on currently authorized translators in the non-reserved, in other words, commercial portion of the FM band, provided that no portion of the 60 dBU contour of the translator extends beyond the smaller of either A, the AM's 2 millivolt contour daytime, or B, a 25-mile radius from the AM's transmitter site, whichever is smaller. To be a currently authorized translator for these purposes, a translator must have been licensed or authorized in a construction permit in effect as of May 1, 2009. In other words, translators whose initial permits are granted after May 1 will not be eligible, nor will any translators whose authorizations, even if granted on or before that date, have since expired. And for all you Class D AM stations, a special break. You will be allowed to originate programming on the translator during time periods when your AM station is not on the air. While this does some violence to the technical concept of translator service, since origination, after all, does not involve translation in any sense, the commission viewed it as in keeping with the agency's desire to bolster the competitive position of AM licensees. These changes have been a couple of years in the making. Back in 2006, the NAB filed a petition for rulemaking proposing the idea of cross-service translation. And in 2007, the commission had started issuing special temporary authorities to let some AM folks translate on a case-by-case basis. Through March 18, 2009, a total of 215 such temporary authorities had been issued. The commission released a notice of proposed rulemaking, moving the ball a bit farther down the field in August 2007, and it looked like the final rules were set to be adopted last fall. But suddenly, the item was removed from the commission's agenda without explanation. Some suspected that the LPFM lobby, which has no love for translators and would prefer to rein in their spread, had made a successful last-ditch effort to derail the proposal. While that disappearance from the regulatory radar screen may have been cause for alarm to some, the commission continued to grant temporary authorities, suggesting strongly that the rules would ultimately be adopted. And sure enough, here they are. The new rules should do the trick for many, if not most, interested AM stations, that is, AM stations subject to multiple interference sources due to the nature of AM technology. They should be able to reach their core service area with FM signals in addition to their AM signals. But there are limitations. For example, while the AM licensee does not necessarily have to own the translator on which its signal is being rebroadcast, the limited financial support rules that apply to FM licensees will equally apply to AMers. If the translator is used for AM fill-in service is not owned by the AM licensee, a rebroadcast consent agreement between the two licensees must be in place. And as to ownership of multiple translators, while a single AM station may own more than one FM translator, the commission will not permit ownership of more than one translator serving the same area. This parallels existing rules for FM stations. By requiring full-service stations, AM or FM, to demonstrate the technical need for more than one translator serving substantially the same area as another previously authorized translator, the commission hopes to prevent monopolization of local spectrum. In this vein, the commission warns ominously that it will consider it an abuse of our rules for a licensee to use two or more cross-service translators to effectively create a de facto FM station. Ditto for a licensee who tries to use two or more FM translators in a manner which circumvents the local radio ownership limits. However, the commission provides no clear indication of how it will identify such situations. One other limitation. Cross-service translation will not be permitted on translators operating on reserved educational channels. While the cross-service translator proponents appear to have achieved a major victory, the LPFM lobby did not go home empty-handed. The currently authorized limitation, in other words, the rule preventing cross-service translation on a translator authorized after May 1, 2009, is intended to cap the universe of eligible translators and prevent any new efforts to squeeze more FM translators out of the FCC's processing line. Providing further assurance along those lines to the LPFM folks, the Commission makes clear in the report and order that the next LPFM application window will be opening before the next FM translator opportunity. No dates for either window have been set, and the smart money figures we probably won't be seeing the LPFM window for at least a year, but you never know. Additionally, the Commission expressly agreed that the LPFM service is generally at cross purposes with the notion of allowing LPFM stations to rebroadcast AM signals. Still, the Commission elected to permit such rebroadcasts as long as they are done in a manner that complies with the LPFM rules. Perhaps the real winners here are those lucky or forward-looking souls who managed to get themselves translator licenses or permits on unreserved channels prior to May 1, 2009. The new rules likely increase the demand for such stations. The supply of those stations is inelastic, having been set in stone as of May 1, 2009. And basic economic principles tell us that in such circumstances, the price to acquire such stations is almost certain to go up, up, up. The new rules will not become effective until they get published in the Federal Register and get blessed by OMB. As of the effective date, all outstanding cross-service translator STAs will be canceled, and any still pending requests for such temporary authorities will be dismissed. Any FM translator licensee currently rebroadcasting AM signals must file written notification specifying the AM primary station pursuant to Section 74.1251C, and they'll have to do that sometime between now and then. And that's the story in the July issue of the blog from Fletcher, Heald & Hildreth Law Firm, written by Ron Whitworth. This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
This is Musings of the Members. The opinions are those of the speaker and do not represent the DX Audio Service, the National Radio Club, or its editors. Members may muse by calling the Action Line, 24 hours a day.
This is Rusty Curry in Eugene, Oregon. And first, I think I can answer the 94 country riddle. That refers to 94.1 KMPS. In the old days, 1300 was KOL, and now it's KKOL, but for quite a while, they were simulcasting KMPS. Also, another note to John Balker. I wonder if you have the sign-on for KOHI St. Helens back when they were Volcano Broadcasting. If you got it, it would be great if you could play it. Now, if you don't, it's really one to get. It's a great routine. They used it for about 25 years, and then about 2005 or 06, they changed ownership and got full-time operation. But if you don't have it, hopefully there would be someone who's an NRC member from the greater Portland area who might have recorded that. That's all for now. Good DX, everyone.
This is Tim Hendel in Huntsville. I noticed on the August DX Audio Service an interesting call in Florence, Kentucky, 1160 WQRT. Does anybody know the format? You know, in ham radio language, QRT means I'm gone. I'm off the air. So it seems a very odd call letters. Also, I have a question about CBE in Windsor. Maybe somebody like Wayne Ryan can answer this. I would not have thought that there'd be any FM frequencies available in the Detroit-Windsor market. How has CBE found a frequency? Did they squeeze in less than four channels away, or did they replace a station? I would like to know if anyone can tell us.
Hello there, DXers. Your friend Josh Owens here in Somerville, Georgia, with a comment and a question. First off, thanks for the update. Forgot who it was last month that left the update about the radio stations in my old stomping grounds in North Carolina, but very informative. Thank you, sir. Got a question. Going through Middle Tennessee back at the end of June and also in the middle of July, heard a beacon on 530. I assume it was a beacon that was playing the same three CW characters over and over again. I can't copy CW, so I don't know what it was. It's in the Middle Tennessee, Murfreesboro area, even up to Manchester and so on and so forth like that. So if anybody knows what that is, let us know.
Hi there, this is Mike Lance in Miami Beach, Florida. Neil Rogers, who worked at WQAM for years, retired, and WQAM is now a sports station all day. They are doing local sports programming, but they are trying to broaden the interest, and they are talking about entertainment and some world issues. I can't understand why radio stations on the weekends have to run infomercials on Saturdays in the morning when they could be doing entertaining programming like Bring Back NBC Monitor, if possible. We have WZAB, which is owned by Salem. They run Haitian programming Saturday night. We have 1080 WMCU, formerly WVCG. They're running Haitian programming Saturday night, and WKAT 1360, which is Spanish, unfortunately, but on Saturday night, they run Haitian programming. Why can't one of the stations do something different, like play some oldies or play some good music? Thanks for listening.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. Just a reminder, our area code 360 numbers are still out of service, and I don't think they're ever coming back. I'm working on a solution, but until I can come up with something, I ask for your patience. The one thing I do want to avoid is having to order another telephone line for the club, which will ultimately have to be paid for by the members and thus raise our dues. So until a solution is found, please write to the address that I give at the start of each edition of the DX Audio Service. As for our musings line, it seems that we have something that's working, well, fairly well. Call area code 646, then 402-5685. That's area code 646-402-5685. The password for the musings line is 62544. 62544. Now, it's very important that you keep your calls very brief and to the point. Before you call, organize your thoughts, get some notes down, get on to the line, and then get off as soon as possible. We don't have unlimited space on the phone system, so a long-winded caller will basically lock out every caller after them. So please keep it brief and to the point. And if you'd like to contact me by email, email can be sent to sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. Please, no jokes, cartoons, or political rantings. Email me only if you have a need to contact me about club business. Well, the Madison-Milwaukee DX get-together is now history. It's an annual event that alternates between two southern Wisconsin cities. And this year, it was held in Madison, Wisconsin on July the 25th. Shortwave DXer Mark Taylor and his wife Terry Ann were the hosts, and judging by the great day that everyone had, they did a fabulous job. It's an all-band event, and there were 24 hobbyists present, including several broadcast band DXers, including Jim Albrecht, Bill Dvorak, George Green, Frank Merrill, and Ernie Wesolowski. If you have never been to one of these events, I'm sure that you'll really enjoy it if you can join them one of these years. In 2010, the event will move back to the Milwaukee area, and according to Tim Noonan, he will host it on Saturday, August 21st, 2010. So mark that down so you don't forget it. Time now for some news and information from Club HQ up in Aurora, Colorado. This comes from Wayne Heinen, who is the chairman of the board for the National Radio Club, and he writes that we have two resignation letters on our desk as of this morning. One is from John Bowker, who will be leaving the National Radio Club's board of directors at the end of the year. John has volunteered many hours in support of the club. The second is from Gary Wilt, who has been our webmaster for nrcdxas.org for a number of years. Gary totally redesigned the site and has faithfully maintained it for several years. Also on the printed side of the club, Paul Swearingen has also announced one more time his intention to retire as the editor of DX News magazine. The board of directors, through its resourcefulness and ingenuity of the past, have tapped ex-chairman Ken Chatterton, and Ken is able to solve the problem of printing and mailing DX News magazine for the past year. But we have no answer to the question of how DX News magazine will continue to be assembled for the printer. Paul has given us a retirement date of May 2010, which is just less than a year away. By the way, speaking of John Bowker, each year the AM Radio Log is published, and there is a dedication to a member. This year, the 30th edition of the AM Radio Log has been dedicated to John Bowker, and I'd like to read the inscription on the inside of the log as it was printed. Over the years, we have dedicated each edition of the log to a club member or log contributor who has supported the efforts to serve the hobby. This year, I have decided to dedicate the log to John D. Bowker. Over the years, John, with gracious help from his lovely wife Linda, has been the chief organizer of many of the National Radio Club's annual conventions. His involvement with the club as our ombudsman smoothed out many a ruffled feather, and his contributions as a member of the board of directors has helped guide our club as well. He's been a cornerstone of the DX audio service with his always entertaining travelogue feature. This year, as John adds to his personal number of years, John has decided to retire from his club activities. We thank John for his many years of volunteer service and wish him a fruitful and relaxing retirement. This from Wayne Heinen, August 6, 2009. Now here is Mark Durenberger with a follow-up to the death of legend Les Paul.
Les Paul, the guitar virtuoso and inventor who revolutionized music and created rock and roll as surely as Elvis Presley and the Beatles by developing the solid body electric guitar and multi-track recording, died recently at age 94. Known for his lightning-fast leads, Paul performed with some of early pop's biggest names and produced a slew of hits, many with wife Mary Ford. But it was his inventive streak that made him universally revered by guitar gods as their original ancestor and earned his induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as one of the most important forces in popular music. Paul, who died in White Plains, New York, of complications from pneumonia, was a tireless tinkerer whose quest for a particular sound led him to create the first solid-body electric guitar, a departure from the hollow-body guitars of the time. His invention paved the way for modern rock and roll and became the standard instrument for legends like Pete Townshend and Jimmy Page. He also developed technology that would become hallmarks of rock and pop recordings, from multi-track recording that allowed for layers and layers of overdubs to guitar reverb and other sound effects. "He was truly the cornerstone of popular music," said Henry Juskowitz, chairman and CEO of Gibson Guitars, which mass-produced Paul's original invention. "He was futurist, and unlike some futurists who write about it and predict things, he was the guy who actually did things." Paul remained an active performer until his last months. He put out his very first rock album just 4 years ago, and up until recently played every week at a New York jazz club. The news of his death prompted an outpouring of tributes from the music world. A tinkerer and musician since childhood, he experimented with guitar amplification for years before coming up in 1941 with what he called the log, a 4x4 piece of wood strung with steel strings. He says, "I went into a nightclub and played it. Of course, everybody had me labeled as a nut." He later put the wooden wings onto the body to give it a traditional guitar shape. The use of electric guitar gained popularity in the mid to late 1940s. Leo Fender's Broadcaster was the first mass-produced solid-body electric on the market in the late 1940s. Gibson solicited Paul to create a prototype for a guitar and began production on the Les Paul guitar in 1952. Townshend of The Who, Steve Howe of Yes, jazz great Al DiMeola, and Led Zeppelin's Page all made the Gibson Les Paul their trademark six-string. The Les Paul series has become one of the most widely used guitars in the music industry. In 2005, Christie's Auction House sold a 1955 Gibson Les Paul for $45,000. Paul was born Lester William Pulfus in Waukesha, Wisconsin, on June 9, 1915. He began his career as a musician, billing himself as Red Hot Red or Rhubarb Red. He toured with the popular Chicago band Rube Tronson and his Texas Cowboys, and he led the house band on WJJD Radio in Chicago. In the mid-1930s, he joined Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians and soon moved to New York to form the Les Paul Trio with Jim Atkins and bassist Ernie Newton. Paul started out as an accompanist, working with key artists until he struck out on his own. His first records were released in 1944 on Decca. Later, with Ford, his wife, from 1949 to 1962, he earned 36 gold records for hits including Vaya Con Dios and How High the Moon, both of which hit number one. He had met Mary Ford, then known as Colleen Summers, in the 1940s while working as a studio musician in Los Angeles. For 7 years in the 1950s, Paul and Ford broadcast a TV show from their home in Mahwah, New Jersey. She died in 1977, 15 years after they divorced. Paul had made his first attempt at audio amplification at age 13. Unhappy with the amount of volume produced by his acoustic guitar, he tried placing a telephone receiver under the strings. Although this worked to some extent, only two strings were amplified and the volume level was still too low. By placing a phonograph pickup in the guitar, all six strings were amplified, and that proved to be much louder. Paul was playing a working prototype of the electric guitar in 1929. His work on recording techniques began in the years after World War II when Bing Crosby gave him a tape recorder. Drawing on his earlier experimentation with his homemade recording machine, Paul added an additional playback head to the recorder. The result was a delayed effect that became known as tape echo. Tape echo gave the recordings a more live feel and enabled the user to simulate different playing environments. Paul's next crazy idea was to stack together eight mono tape machines and send their outputs to one piece of tape, stacking the recording heads on top of each other. The resulting machine served as the forerunner to today's multi-track recorders. Many of their songs used overdubbing techniques that Paul helped develop. He said, "I could take Mary and make her 3, 6, 9, 12, as many voices as I wished," he recalled. The overdubbing technique was highly influential on later recording artists. Paul's use of multi-track recording was unique. Before he did it, most recordings were made on a single tape. By recording each element separately, from the vocals to instrumentation on different tracks, they could be mixed and layered, adding to the richness and sound. In the old days, if you only had one track, you put a microphone in the middle of the music and you'd hope for the best, Jusko had said. In 1954, Paul commissioned the first 8-track tape recorder, known as Cell Sync, in which a recording head could simultaneously record a new track and play back previous ones. And this is my own comment. It is known among the music industry that Les Paul occasionally took credit for things that he didn't necessarily invent. In this case, Cell Sync was originally developed by Ross Snyder of Ampex. In the late 1960s, Paul retired from music to concentrate on his inventions. His interest in country music was rekindled in the mid-1970s, and he teamed up with Chet Atkins for two albums. The duo were awarded a Grammy for Best Country Instrumental Performance in 1976 for their Chester and Lester album. In 2005, he released the Grammy-winning Les Paul and Friends, American Made, World Played, his first album of new material since those 1970s recordings, and his first official rock CD. Among those playing with him, Peter Frampton, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, and Richie Sambora. Paul told the Associated Press, "They're not only my friends. I've never stopped being amazed by all the ways of playing the guitar and making it deliver a message." Les Paul was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2005. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Earlier you heard me talk about the AM Radio Log. The 30th edition is out just in time for the National Radio Club Convention. The AM Radio Log is a source of information on AM radio stations in the United States and Canada. The 30th edition of the log will contain 278 pages of data and cross-references and 18 pages of instructions in 8.5x11 size, three-hole punched U.S. loose-leaf format. This publication will fit nicely into a 1-inch three-ring binder, and nearly 9,000 updates have been made since last year's 29th edition of the AM Radio Log. Additional reference lists include call letters of FM and FM translator simulcasts, listings of regional groups of stations in the groups section. That's a separate section in the back of the logbook, by the way. And the cross-reference of those stations that are licensed to use IBOC, digital audio. Shipping will begin about September the 1st, just in time for the convention, and pre-orders are being accepted now. Orders are shipped post-paid, media rate, U.S.-Canadian members at $3.50 if you want them sent by priority mail. Orders can be sent to the National Radio Club Publication Center, Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251, or you can order off the website at www.nrcdxas.org. For United States members, the cost is $19.95. For United States non-members, it's $25.95. For Canadian members, it's $24. For Canadian non-members, it's $29. And for outside the United States, member or non-member, $33. The type style is appropriate for use with screen readers. So if you have a scanner, you'll be able to use the AM radio log as reference. Sean Axelrod hosts a column in DX News magazine called The DXer's Toolbox. These are shared tips and information from National Radio Club members. And this month we have a question from one of our readers. He writes, I use a Kiwa loop antenna. I've always heard that portable loop antennas should be kept, quote, a considerable distance away, unquote, from, quote, large metal objects, unquote, in order to avoid having their reception loops and nulls become skewed. Now, to me, this begs two questions, to wit, number one, what constitutes a large metal object? An 18-wheeler? A car? A refrigerator? An HQ-180? A can of pork and beans? And two, what constitutes a considerable distance? A length of a football field, 10 feet, 6 inches? This may sound like a couple of frivolous questions, but they have been dogging me for some time as I attempt to situate my Kiwa at an optimum length from everything else metal in my DX shack. I hope you can shed some light on the answers in an upcoming edition of the DX Toolbox column. Signed, Guy Cuddlemeyer of Thurston, Oregon. Guy has some good questions, writes Sean. I have two broadcast band loops in my radio room, a 4-foot box loop, and an older ferrite quantum loop antenna. The coaxial lead from my box loop was meant to be no more than 6 feet, according to the original designer of the loop I based my unit on. This would allow it to tilt and swivel, but still keep the coax short. So maybe we should say not more than 6 feet away and, for smaller loops, such as the quantum loop, 3 feet as they turn and tilt on the radius is smaller. This limits where in the radio room I can place the loops. As for outdoor loops, such as the ones Wellbrook sell, well, they want to be mounted up about 6 meters or 20 feet away from any buildings. Now, all my radios have metal cabinets, so the loops are never far, 3 to 6 feet, from them, and I have no problems with nulls or directionability of the loops. I would have to say, in this case, the radio is not a large metal object, so perhaps your refrigerator could be classified as a large metal object. I would avoid large appliances not only for the metal content, but also for the electrical or electronics they hold in them. My radio room is basically metal-free of large objects, but they are close in the utility room, washer, dryer, fridge, freezer, and furnace. They seem to be no real problem with them, but then I have never been in a place with a loop free of everything metal. I can tell you that a metal-sided trailer is no fun. I have to be near a window to get a good signal, so an 18-wheeler would really be a pain to DX next to. The best bet is to try the Kiwa loop in a few places in the radio room. You will have to find that sweet spot for it to work the best. There may be other things in and around the radio room that could affect the loop's performance. I know of one DXer who had a large buzz on his ferrite loop from a readout on his ICOM ICR-71A, but my ICOM ICR-70 did not have the same effect on the loop. He had to have it at least 3 feet away to null the buzz. I hope this was of some help, Guy. Several DX Audio Service members have expressed to me their wanting to get an edge on their listening and kind of gear up for the winter DX season, and were wondering exactly what they could do to help their receiver out. Well, most radios have their own internal antennas, and some are better than others, but there are ways to enhance your listening and maybe get the satisfaction of building something yourself. And that is a loop antenna. The obvious first choice is to buy one, and the basic Select antenna, that's an AM radio antenna, comes to mind. These are available at Walmart, Kmart. You can also get them off the web or buy from mail order. This device is about 12 inches across and 4 inches thick and has a dial in the center. The design has been around for about 30 years and used by hundreds of thousands of people that either DX or just listen to radio casually. The Model 541 produces a signal gain of about 30 dB when used with most AM radio receivers which have an internal ferrite rod antenna. You simply place the Select antenna against the back of your radio, then tune the large knob to the frequency that you're listening to. A lot of National Radio Club members will use this along with their mini ultralight radios, such as the SRF-39FP, affectionately known as the prison radio because you can see right through it. However, it will work well with the Sony ICF-2010 or the GE Super Radio 3, or just about any radio that has an internal loop antenna. Another version of this loop is the Select Antenna Model 541M. The Select Antenna 541M is the same as the original 541, but it features a 3.5mm mini jack on the front panel that allows the loop to be connected to an AM radio's antenna input terminal. Note, to connect it to your radio, the radio must have an antenna input terminal. Ultralight radios don't normally have these inputs, but radios like the GE Super Radio 3 and the Sony ICF-2010 do. Personally, I like the 541M because I can leave my radio sit in its natural position on the desk and only move the loop around to peak and null stations. A small piece of RG58 coax is all I need to connect between the radio and the loop antenna. Now, if you would like to make your own loop, they're really not that hard to build. A loop like this is basically several turns of wire on a fixed form, with a tuning capacitor across the coil. I made one just for the heck of it out of a Quaker Oats box, which is about 5 inches around as far as I can recall, and made of cardboard, which is, well, sort of an insulator. The wire was wound around the box, and each end of the coil was attached to a 360 picofarad tuning cap taken from a dead radio receiver. Listening to 870 WWL out of New Orleans, I would get about an S5 on the radio, but when the coil was placed next to the radio and peaked to 870 kHz, the radio came to life with a S10 plus signal. This also allowed me to hear about 75 more radio stations in 1 year, as well as hear stations on adjacent frequencies from locals, because I could null the local station out by positioning the antenna and peaking on the adjacent frequency. Now, another option, if you'd like to just buy an antenna, is the Kiwa Pocket Loop. It is a 12.5-inch air core loop that collapses to fit in your pocket. You've heard this used on some of the DX Audio Service shows, as Mark Dernberger has used it on many occasions to snag some clear channel DX. Now, this antenna is designed to enhance the medium wave and short wave reception of portable receivers. The tuning range of this antenna is from 530 to 23 megahertz in 4 bands using a battery-powered low-noise amplifier. This small package and performance does come at a price of $195, but as the old saying goes, you get what you pay for. This small loop also comes ready to fly right out of the box, and it's a must for any DX Audio Service members who are looking for something compact that they can take with them on travels or have at home on a desk without taking up a lot of space. Now, since I tend to be an experimenter, I've built several loops, and my favorite were the ferrite loop and the box loop. The ferrite loop consists of 33 turns of lince wire around a 1.25-inch coil form with a ferrite bar positioned inside the coil, and then a tuning capacitor in an adjacent box. In the late 1980s, I made these for several other DXers under the name Super Loop, and I sold about 250 of them. As fast as I could make them, they would go out the door. Along with the coil and capacitor was a small FET amplifier, which would provide about 18 dB of amplification. The nice thing about the loop was that it was compact, and tuning was very narrow for peaks on AM radio channels while the adjacent channels were suppressed. The bad thing about the Super Loop was it was fragile, and a drop test off the table always resulted in a broken ferrite bar. However, the pros outweighed the cons, and the loop held up to the task of ferreting out DX from numerous locations. Most of all, the loop was small and could sit easily on the desk with no problem. The box loop, on the other hand, was the granddaddy of all loops. I really preferred it to all loops for numerous reasons. First, it had more ability to null local signals. Here in Lima, I've got a 1 kilowatt non-directional daytime station at 1150 kilohertz. At night, they go directional due north with 1 kilowatt. The station is exactly 5 miles from my location on a vector of 165 degrees. That's roughly south-southeast. Although this station puts in a fairly hefty signal, I was still able to log Hamilton, Ontario, Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, Utica, New York, and I have a tentative logging of Salina, Kansas. Tentative means that I never heard the station's call sign or station slogan, but ads and mentions of Interstate 70 and 135, among other things, have me pretty confident that it was KSAL in Salina. How is this possible? Well, the loop antenna has the ability to null out a local signal well into the noise floor. When you do that, whatever is left on the frequency can be heard. I should mention that loops can be somewhat handy to null semi-local or distant stations, but the shifting sky wave and ground wave will always be a fight. Once you null a ground wave signal, the sky wave signal will still come in and fade out, so there is somewhat of a struggle. However, with some patience, you can get results. I was able to null out 760 WJR in Detroit, which is 108 miles away from me, to hear another station on 760 doing a DX test. The box loop that I made was based on an article in the National Radio Club's Antenna Reference Manual, Volume 1, which is available from the Publication Center. The specific article was on page 34, entitled The Bob Flick Loop, after National Radio Club member Bob Flick. And here is what the downside of this loop comes in. The loop measures 24 inches by 24 inches and about 12 inches thick. It sits on a base that is elevated about 8 inches above the table. Therefore, moving it around requires some real estate on the table. My loop also incorporated a low-noise FET amplifier and a high-Q tuning input, and a buffered distribution amplifier to send the signal to multiple receivers. I ended up selling the loop to another DXer as I didn't have the space in my small studio for the antenna. But now I really miss it. And I'm thinking of building another one, but this one is going to be built outside the house and remotely tuned using servo motors. This would allow the antenna to be up and in the open, which I think will help me in some cases. Loops can be intimidating and challenging, but they can be fun to build. My blind friend Brian built one for, well, next to nothing, and here's how he did it. First of all, he did have to take the hit of purchasing a large tuning capacitor from Nebraska Surplus Sales. According to Brian, it was their part number CAV-75-37, and it was rather expensive, costing $50. He admits that it could have been next to nothing to build had he taken apart an old defunct radio and used a 20 to 300 picofarad capacitor, but he didn't have the heart to take apart the radio. Perhaps if you try this project, you can find a friend that has a capacitor that they would be willing to give you for nothing or maybe just a few dollars. Anyways, he took the capacitor, and then a cardboard box that is Braille and Speak came in and duct taped the capacitor onto the box. Then he installed a large plastic knob on the tuning capacitor shaft, so when he touched the capacitor, his body didn't short out the circuit. Then by trial and error, he wrapped 22-gauge solid core wire around the box. He found that making 10 turns around the box gave him the right range he needed. Now when he wants to DX, he places his GE Super Radio 2 next to the box, dials in the frequency on the GE radio, and then tunes the loop with the capacitor. Like the select antenna, when he hits the resonance on the loop, the signals explode from his receiver. For example, when he dials his radio onto a frequency, a station may be well into the noise. However, when the loop is peaked, the signal comes in to what can only be described as local quality. Again, through trial and error, Brian found out that by adding turns to the coil, he could get low-band stations in the 150 to 400 kHz region. And by eliminating turns, he could get tropical stations in the 3 to 4 MHz range. He has since added a switch to add and subtract turns in the coil, and has heard stations from the UK and even Colombia in South America. So you see, it's not that hard to do. As Brian comments, "I'm sure it doesn't look pretty. I don't care. It does bring in the stations." The downside to all loops is that they will amplify signals. So if you live in an area that has sufficient noise, such as bad power lines or a neighbor's plasma TV, in some cases, you might be amplifying that noise, but having the ability to null means that you can also null that noise. That's a bonus. So if you're looking for something fun to do this fall in preparation for what could be a very active AMDX season, think about purchasing or building your own loop antenna. And please, let all of us know what you hear on your loop antenna.
You'll be killing an innocent man just to prove your insane theory.
Nonsense, my child. A brain transfer will be an unparalleled triumph in medical history.
Oh, at least not with a chicken.
Now stand back, my dear, while I throw the switch.
Look what you've done.
Yes, drat. The fuse is blown and now my radio won't play. And there's chicken doo-doo all over my Bunsen burner.
WIPC! Say, how about we finish up this edition of the DX Audio Service with a few jingles? Until next time, 73, good DX, and get out and support radio.
KNBR 68 plays the music you love.
WCAR.
makes you feel good all over.
I do enjoy it here in Detroit, because each day's up to here in WCAR.
The day is over. We leave tonight with the hope to be with you.
WTOD, Toledo, Ohio, concluding another day of broadcasting. WTOD is owned and operated by the Booth Broadcasting Company, a division of the Booth American Company, and broadcasts on a federally assigned frequency of 1,560 kilocycles with a daytime power of 5,000 watts. WTOD's studios and transmitter are located at 3225 Arlington Avenue in Toledo, Ohio. And now you're invited to tune to Toledo's only 24-hour FM radio station, WTOD-FM, 99.9 megacycles. Until tomorrow morning, then, from the staff and management of WTOD-AM, a pleasant good evening.
That's all, folks.
Good night. Cha-cha-cha.